Welcome to Seasteading Today. This is Randolph Henkin, Executive Director of the Seasteading Institute. This week, we're broadcasting Episode 6 of Anthony Caprio's Free Cities podcast, which was originally posted at freecitiespodcast.libsyn.com. I hope you enjoy and learn something from the conversation you're about to hear between Anthony and Seavangelist Joe Quirk. As always, we appreciate your interest in seasteading and invite you to join the Institute as a contributing member at our website, seasteading.org. Without any further ado, here's the Free Cities podcast.
Mommy, I want an ice cream.
All right, sweetie. Do you want chocolate, vanilla, or the unlimited flavors of voluntary cooperation? You're listening to the Free Cities Podcast with Anthony Caprio, the podcast that explores free markets and decentralization as a solution to problems. Join us as we explore voluntary alternatives to the top-down approach. Keep an open mind as we explore a voluntary solution for every aspect of life. You're in for an amazing journey. And now, here's Anthony.
Hello, and welcome to the Free Cities podcast. Our guest today is Joe Quirk. Joe is a science writer, novelist, and memoir ghostwriter with a national bestseller in each category. He co-authored a book with Patry Friedman, Seasteading: How Floating Cities Will Free the World, which will be published by Simon & Schuster in 2016. He has consulted for Pixar, who volunteered to illustrate his presentation for college students. He is currently the communications director for the Seasteading Institute, as well as an aquapreneur, matchmaker. Joe, welcome to the show. Please fill in any gaps from my intro and then tell us what the Seasteading Institute does.
As you said, I'm a Seavangelist for it. It's a nonprofit think tank founded by Patry Friedman and Peter Thiel, and we seek to build startup societies that float in international waters. And that seems like a crazy idea to people, but like, what if you could empower anyone to remake society from the ground up as many times as you wanted? And the only catch is you can't do it from the ground, and you can't do it with political force. So when you consider that nearly half the world's surface is unclaimed by any existing government, you realize this is the blue frontier for voluntary societies. And we plan to provide the platforms to settle this frontier. And if we can combine cruise ship technology with oil platform technology, we'd have permanent cities on the sea, and these would be platforms for voluntary entrepreneurial societies.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great description of the Seasteading Institute and what you're doing. So bring me up to date on the latest development with the Seasteading Institute. I see you've got a lot of new content up on your website.
Yeah, right now we're engaged in negotiations with different stages of negotiations with several host nations. The big stride to seasteading would a floating city in international waters. And so far that's looking too expensive. It's too big a jump. So mm-hmm. We want to demonstrate the business model of an independent small floating city.
Sure.
And to do that, we need to go to shallow waters. And the problem with shallow waters is they're controlled by existing states.
Right.
So we're looking for countries that already have like special economic zones, which are basically legal islands inside their borders.
Right.
And we're going to them and saying, hey, you know, we don't even need any of your land. Allow us to build some platforms, provide us the legislation for as much political autonomy as we can get. Mm-hmm. And there's no, you know, there's no way you can lose if we can provide the platforms and bring in the investors and build some businesses, and you grant us some independence, and we hire some local people, and you have some off-coast prosperity. This will be good for your country, and you'll be seen as pushing forward the future. So what's good for us is we'll get to demonstrate the business model for free societies. And we'd start with like two platforms and then go to 11 platforms is the plan. And then we'll hopefully discover solutions for how to go to the high seas.
Well, that sounds really, really exciting. And Yeah, I definitely think that's the right strategy to go with, you know, and proving the concept first and in more protected shallow waters. And I love the idea too of, you know, you're reaching out basically to be a special economic zone, which should be pretty appealing for most developing countries, I would think, because they don't actually have to do any of the work. It's not, you know, infringing on anyone's property that's on land, and you're basically just showing up with and helping to build a new industry within the country.
And when you think about it, like seasteads, these would be the ultimate startup. These floating cities would be governance startups. A little while ago, we met with Tim Draper of the Six Californias Initiative.
Okay.
He has this great idea to break up California into six states, so they would have to compete with each other for businesses and citizens.
Absolutely. I'm 100% behind that idea. I live in California, and I think it's desperately needed.
Yeah, and of course, you know, no surprise, government said no, people didn't understand it. But imagine if six Californias could break up and float away. Imagine if neighborhoods could break up according to the choices and values of the people who work there and go form their own societies as they choose. We would see a market of governance competing to attract citizens. And what convinced me to become a C-evangelist was when I realized this would be variation by cities and selection by citizens, and that variation and selection is that secret recipe for innovation and progress, which we enjoy in technologies and consumer goods, and we'd unleash this kind of progress in governance. And I happened to hear about this from Patry Friedman at Burning Man, and I realized it's not a futuristic fantasy because I'd just been on a cruise ship.
Yeah.
And cruise ships are mostly self-governing, and they have been for decades. They've already demonstrated the model. And the floating city I was on provided way more services than my city,
right.
A lot more cheaply. It was extravagant, and it was very comfortable. And I don't have to argue about how it's governed.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but it's funny that you brought up the cruise ship example, because I went on a cruise a couple of years ago, and what I was noting was that I was a surface warfare officer in the Navy, and our platform was minesweeping ships. Our mission was to go out and look for underwater mines that could blow up other ships, and I was an engineering officer. I worked, you know, down in the engineering spaces, and I was amazed at how difficult it was for us oftentimes to even get underway, you know, with these ships that we were on. I mean, there were so many times where, you know, we would break down, we couldn't even pull away from the dock. You know, just basic systems would not work. And it wasn't because, you know, we had bad sailors or anything else like that. The sailors that I had working for me were great. But a lot of the equipment that we were forced to use, you know, was picked out for us by the government. And, you know, we didn't have great support from a lot of our contractors. And then every time that we pulled into port, you know, we would almost always have someone get hospitalized from being in a fight or get arrested. And, you know, the food wasn't that great. The living conditions weren't that great. And so then, you know, years later, I went on board a cruise ship, and I was kind of hesitant to get on board the cruise ship because I was like, you know, I've spent enough time at sea, and I've kind of been through all that. But this cruise ship was amazing. Like, I couldn't believe, like, they got underway on time every single time. The food was incredible, and there was so much of it. And then every port that we pulled into, they would disembark, you know, the 3,000 passengers or whatever it was on board. They would go out into some foreign port. To my knowledge, nobody got arrested, you know, or we didn't have to, like, wait. The ship didn't have to wait for anybody to get back on board. And it was just 100 times more efficient than what I'd experienced in the Navy. And, you know, for obviously the cruise ships weren't looking for mines, but for doing a similar mission of just getting out to sea and going into another port. But I think a big part of that, of what helps with the cruise ships is the competition. You know, there's so many different lines to choose from.
So you've personally experienced the difference between, you know, market a market society on ships and kind of a government monopoly run ship. It fascinates me. Like, a lot of people think, like, if there's a disaster at sea or terrorism or something, the military will run out and rescue you. And I was astonished to find often it's the opposite. If a military ship gets in trouble and sinks at sea, they call upon private salvors to come rescue them and even pull their, you know, sunken ships off the bottom of the ocean. So even the military is calling upon the private market to come deal with their problems at sea. I would love to hear more about your experience as a Navy man, because I'm amazed at how many people interested in seasteading are former Navy men.
Right. Well, so I actually wrote an article called Maritime Defense. And in the article, I kind of talked about the model of private defense versus the Navy. And the example that I provided was the case of piracy, you know, off the coast of Africa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for as little as like $30,000, a merchant ship can hire, you know, a crew, basically, a defense force to come and be on their ship. And the ships that have hired these private defense forces have never been boarded by pirates, much less, you know, had anyone kidnapped or anything else like that. So I think it says a lot about the private model, you know, when navies exist. You know, the U.S. Navy has a huge presence in that region, you know, and you know, people in the Navy are great. You know, a lot of my best friends are still in. But there's something in the way that it's structured, which makes it, unfortunately, kind of slow to respond to emergencies. And whereas as kind of the market solution, these different shipping lines have been able to kind of tailor what their defense needs are, you know, for these different regions that they're in. And so they've been able to contract out to different companies to protect their ships as they're going from point A to point B. And, you know, it was actually brought up even in my time in the Navy about privatizing minesweeping, you know, and searching for mines. And it's actually an idea that I completely agree with and wholeheartedly support. I saw firsthand, unfortunately, how ineffective we were in that role a lot of times with some of the exercises and things that we went on. We just weren't very good at finding mines, the thing that we were supposed to do. And, you know, when you look at different salvagers that are out there, and when you look at private individuals like James Cameron, you know, he was able to find the Titanic, you know, in the Atlantic Ocean, and he was able to go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, you know, with nothing but his own funding, you know, as far as I know. And he was able to accomplish these amazing things that, you know, the government probably couldn't accomplish or didn't accomplish. So I think it says a lot for the private market and for allowing competition.
And based on your personal experience, what do you think was the difference? Why is the Navy not as good at getting its job done when it has lots of capable people, whereas a lot of these private industries are?
Well, the biggest thing that I saw was we kind of had our hands tied with the equipment that we could use. So if we had, you know, say we had an issue with some of our diesel generators that we were using, with them just constantly breaking down and just being really difficult to maintain. And I remember one time there was an admiral that came down to talk to our crew, and, you know, he basically did like an ask me anything, you know, kind of session. And one of my sailors raised his hand and said, "Sir, when can we get rid of these diesel generators? You know, they've got all these different maintenance problems." And he basically said, "Well, you know, unfortunately, that's the contract that we have, and, you know, there's really nothing we can do about it." And that was coming from an admiral, you know. And, he basically admitted, you know, there's nothing that we can do about this contract that we have for this really bad equipment. So that was part of it. We didn't have the freedom of choice, you know, for when we had a bad supplier, we couldn't just pick up and go to another supplier. So that was one element of it. The other part of it was, and this is a little bit unique to the kind of ship that I was on, minesweepers, at least in those days, they had what they called rotational crews. So crews would rotate from one ship to another. And so you had kind of a case of the tragedy of the commons, where, you know, you would have a crew that would be on a ship for, you know, maybe 6 months. And so they didn't have a lot invested in it. And it was hard to convince, you know, a 19, 20-year-old kid to really maintain his equipment when he knew that in a few months he was going to be gone and didn't have to see it again. Mm-hmm. And so then our crew would come in, and we were more of an engineering and maintenance crew. So we would have to fix up all these minesweepers that everybody else had neglected for so long. So I think kind of that combination of the tragedy of the commons and not having competition as far as who your suppliers were really what put us in some kind of bad situations, I thought. And really it was, we were lucky that we had some really exceptional sailors, you know, that got us out of some bad situations. But, you know, when I looked at the private cruise ships, you know, I saw their staffs, you know, were from all over the world. A lot of them, you know, I think came from third world countries that, you know, might not have a whole lot of education, but they were running these immaculate cruise ships, you know, that got underway on time every time, got all the passengers back on board, you know, safely, no matter what port they pulled into, and then yeah. Served these incredible meals, you know, for everyone to enjoy. And, so I think a lot of it has to do with the ownership and with kind of the lack of feedback mechanism that you see oftentimes in government, where there's, you know, you can fail and there's not a whole lot of consequences for it, or they'll just kind of cover up their failures. They'll kind of whitewash it and, you know, make it so it doesn't look as bad as it is and still declare victory and go on to the next thing.
Yeah, and it's like you guys were actually being put in danger, it sounds like to me, when you were in the Navy, by, even though you had lots of capable people, you're inside sort of like a Sovietized, socialized system where all your stuff is just, you know, taken by confiscation. and you know what I mean? Like your engines that are not working well, you know, there's just one choice you have, and it's what the government gives you. And then there's not someone else working to make a safer engine, and you don't have people hustling to make profits to make things even better, so that the Navy men don't choose a different Navy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw that firsthand with some of the contractors that I worked with. You know, where because I was kind of our ship's liaison with our civilian contractors, and you know, times where we needed them to stay late or, you know, work the weekends or whatever to try and meet a deadline, you know, they just were like, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, I've worked in the private sector and, you know, on projects, similar to engineering projects, and, my contractors are always, you know, yes, sir, but whatever you need, you know, they're willing to work the overtime to get the overtime pay. And, yeah.
Because the incentives are all aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, people do what they're incentivized to do.
Right.
I definitely believe that.
And the thing that drives constant improvement in cruise ship governance for both the customer and the employees is the right to jump ship.
Yeah.
you can just, you know, people sometimes quit one cruise line and then join another. And certainly customers choose all different kinds of cruise lines. And this is all driving profits. And so it's also driving, I mean, what's great about a cruise ship where I don't have to argue about politicians is that I don't have to trust the selfless motives of the governance provider in the marketplace. I don't even have to know them. I can just trust their self-interest in serving me better than others competing to find new ways to get me to volunteer my dollar or my attention or my labor. And I think the story you tell in your personal experience is a great example of how private governance can work better than state governance. And a little fact I like to cite is that the gross oceanic product of the cruise ship industry has grown at more than twice the rate of the gross domestic product of the USA since 1980.
Wow.
So this, if you think of the cruise ship as a country where a population, 22 million people, a population equivalent to the island nation of Taiwan, temporarily chooses private governance at sea every year, and it keeps growing. I'm already seeing the rise of this kind of freewheeling, private open market of governance, where the incentives are more aligned for everyone to provide the best service at the lowest cost. And, you know, even though the pirate waters are less than 1% of the total oceans, it's like, you're right, there's a presence from like several major countries in that Horn of Africa area where it's dangerous. And yet they're not able to protect the cargo ships that go through there. So I happen to know that at this point, 3/4 of cargo ships have private security on board. And you're correct.
Right.
So far, no one has ever boarded a ship with private security. And the insurance providers for cruise ships, they charge much lower rates if the cargo ships have private security on board. So everybody is incentivized to provide security. And there's all sorts of insurance that provides, you know, ransom in case of kidnap. I mean, some of these cargo ships have cargo that's worth literally more than $100 million on one boat.
Wow.
You know, people want to insure this stuff, and going across the oceans is a harrowing thing. And for the most part, you break down in the middle of the ocean, there's no Navy or Coast Guard going to ride out there and save you. You have to rely on market mechanisms.
Right.
And when you consider that literally 90% of the goods we consume on a day-to-day basis come from the ocean, you're seeing this open network on 45% of the Earth's surface, where there is no state governance, is already working, and it's emerging. And it's like a secret voluntary society that's quietly out-competing even the Navy in things like providing protection.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, Joe, I wanted to talk a little bit, because one of the questions I had, and I was just wondering if you could answer it for me, is I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the engineering challenges associated with living at sea. And I don't know how much the Seasteading Institute has kind of dug into that, but, you know, obviously having anything at sea takes an incredible amount of maintenance. It's a very corrosive environment. Are there some engineering breakthroughs that you're aware of that is going to help to make floating cities on the ocean kind of more of a viable option?
So the basic challenges are waves, which make things unstable. And another challenge is the corrosive nature of seawater.
Right.
So, you know, most oil platforms, you know, they'll last about 25 years on the ocean, and, you know, and then they have to be serviced.
Right.
So you need something that's going to be stable in high waves, and you need something that's not going to corrode over time. And usually the cheapest thing is cement, because it's strong, it's big, it's heavy, and it can float really well, but it degrades, and the rebar in cement degrades. So this is part of the problem. This is why cruise ships work so well, because by moving through the ocean constantly, they remain stable.
Right.
And they can come into shore now and then. So the challenge for, let's talk about the corrosive stuff. Consider first that there are underwater aqueducts and structures built by the Romans during the Roman Empire that are still solid underneath the water.
Wow. So
cement structures that stand up for centuries, that technology was created in the Roman Empire using like volcanic ash mixed with other things, and it was lost for a long time. And it's since been reclaimed and re-understood. And so people kind of use that as a model to create something new. And a pretty exciting guy who's a pretty do-it-yourself seasteader named Michael Elliott has been experimenting with geopolymer concrete, which he says is, first of all, it's carbon negative, unlike other, one of the worst things for putting carbon in the air is simply the production of cement. So his geopolymer concrete, it cures in much less the time. It can last centuries in seawater. It floats really well. It's cheaper. It's easier to repair. It has all these marvelous characteristics, and he's experimenting with it. And I think the advancement of materials is happening on numerous fronts. This is just one example. So creating solid structures that can last centuries in seawater is nascent. It's coming.
Sure.
The other problem is, how do you create something stable on the waves? If you just put a platform on the high seas, you're just going to be seasick unless you're moving.
Right.
So Robert Ballard, the very first discoverer of the Titanic and pretty much the most famous oceanographer, he was just talking to us a couple weeks ago, and he proposes what's called the flip structure, a technology which has been on the water since 1962, which is basically shaped like a baseball bat, and you can kind of tow it out to the water, and then you use kind of ballast tanks to flip it upright so that like 5/5 of it is below the water and 1/5 of it is above the water. And it's very heavy at the bottom, and it's described as being as stable as a fence post in 60-foot waves.
Wow.
And this is basically what oil platforms already use, the basic idea, which is, you know, basically four flips with a platform on it. And when you think, like on land, we build skyscrapers straight up, defying the most ubiquitous force in the universe, which is gravity.
Right.
And, you know, why are we working so hard to build against gravity? It's very expensive. Well, because going down, building straight down is even more hard. But the ocean flips this perception. And we allow the most ubiquitous force in the universe to be your friend. So the deeper you can build ballast, the more stable it is in the waves. And there's a Malaysian designer, architect, whose name I can't pronounce. His name is like Sarli Barkun. And he's already built what he calls the O scraper, which is basically an upside down skyscraper, which goes very deep below the oceans. And the more weight you can have down there, the more solid and stable it is up high. And then you can also build these very high above the water. So it's funny to realize that the place where waves are a problem is at the air-ocean interface. So, you know, 30 meters below the ocean, waves are not that much of a problem. 30, you know, maybe much higher above the ocean, waves are not a problem. So you can build your city on, like, pontoon structures that go much higher than the waves and hold your city above the waves. And then you can build heavy, deep ballast deep below the water and create stability in high waves on the ocean if you build a bigger, heavy enough structure.
Okay.
And I facilitated a conversation between Bob Ballard and our former managing director at the Seasteading Institute, Chris Mulia, and they discussed 3D printed seasteads on the ocean.
Wow.
3D printing is – the technologies get faster and cheaper. Everything basically doubles every year.
Right.
So we're already printing houses, and the Chinese have printed a mansion and a 5-story apartment house, and they look beautiful. You can look at them online. And these print heads are just going to get faster and cheaper. And as construction technology, as more and more elements of it become an information technology, you can imagine you design these things online, you email it to your seastead, you try one out, you find improvements, that the building floating structures with new materials on the ocean could get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And Chris is also partnered with like leading nanotechnologists who are looking at making these things, you know, porous like bone, you know, self-healing. There's
wow.
all sorts of advancements being made with regard to materials and construction costs. And if these can be engaged to build seasteads, we could have organic structures like, you know, that imitate seashells and corals on the ocean. And we'd have fundamentally different things on the sea. Now, you know, I'm talking about the future. I'm talking about,
sure.
you know, a decade from now. You know, according to some of these 3D printing guys, they think in a decade from now we could have radically different material structures. But the basic idea of new materials that don't corrode in seawater and deep ballast beneath the ocean to deal with waves, those are the fundamental engineering challenge. And that also attacks the considerable cost challenge, because the idea is to get these things cheaper. We're such
right.
middle-class families, we want to move out there.
Right.
And then it's just a matter of coming up with the business model that's gonna pay for this. If you grant free jurisdictions on the water to businesses, who would be interested in making a lot more money on a seastead than they could in one of the existing land governments?
That was my next question. Yeah, that was my next question. Is what are some of the industries that would be on seasteads that would generate enough revenue to justify, you know, their placement on the sea?
So I'll talk about the pioneers that are most interested in right now, and then I'll talk about the industries I would like to court, even
okay.
though every seasteader disagrees with this. So. First, there's a guy named Neil Sims who runs the Velella Research Project. And the Velella is a little animal that scoots across the water using a little sail. It's a beautiful little creature. And he basically imitates this concept for fish farms on the deep sea, which are basically floating fish cages that are unattached to anything and float in circular eddies behind big islands. And so it's basically you're farming wild fish. So if you can imagine Buckminster Fuller bucky balls, you know, shaped like soccer balls, you know, several meters below the ocean that float in eddies and swim along with schooling fish. And you can follow these things by GPS and then catch up to them and get your fish out and then put, you know, new fingerlings back in there and grow your fish.
Wow.
It's a pretty amazing deep sea business yeah. model. And he basically solves every problem with fish farms. You know, there's been no measurable environmental impact. The fish is healthier than wild,
mm-hmm.
has no parasites, no mercury, no nothing. And a higher omega-3 content. Much higher than farmed fish and wild fish. So it's better than wild. And the problem is that all the fish farming regulations written by existing countries are designed to control the type of fish farms that are, you know, bolted to your coast, and then they give off all this poop, and then you have to, you know, treat them like, you know, bovines in a feedlot system and spray, you know, anti-biofoulants and all this sort of stuff, which
right.
he just doesn't need. So he's got this marvelous technology he wants to do on the high seas. So he's curious to partner with the Seasteading Institute so we could have the platforms out there to scale this thing up in international waters.
Right.
So you could have workers out there and you could have people living there. And you know, his whole message, as is Bob Ballard's, is first you provide the farms, and then the cities will follow. And so he wants a fish farm. So he thinks outside the box. He thinks outside the box of existing countries. He sees this as the way to feed the world with sustainable sashimi. So he's, you know, one of the guys partnering with the Seasteading Institute already and curious, kind of impatient for us to get out there and do stuff. As far as people that I would like to court, and we have the first few people who have solicited to us, I think medical research that is radically delayed by obsolete regulatory pathways, you can literally save them hundreds of millions of dollars by speeding things up just a few years. Also, the islands around the U.S. are being filled with health cities. In the Cayman Islands and in San Martin Island, all, the Caribbean islands are all building fabulous health cities to catch the rising wave of dissatisfied Americans who don't want to fly to India to get cheaper, better, faster health care.
Right.
So there's a famous Indian heart surgeon named Devi Shetty who's already built a multi-billion dollar health city in the Cayman Islands and is providing much cheaper health care. And Americans are flying there. Their companies are paying them to fly there because it's cheaper if they have like a knee injury. Insurance companies are encouraging people to go overseas. And Devi Shetty, the guy who built this place in the Cayman Islands, said in the Economic Times that the best place to have a floating hospital is off the coast of an existing American city.
Wow.
So I think if we could build floating seasteads 12 miles offshore, a ferry ride away, operating under a new regulatory regime that would be based on 21st century medicine, not 20th century medicine,
right?
You could just completely outcompete this old, you know, crusty, antiquated healthcare system we have in the USA, which, you know, is becoming more and more micromanaged by governments, and it's going to end up, perhaps it already is, like the Navy you worked at. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that is a scary thought. I mean, it's already getting bad. I mean, I can't believe, you know, what I paid every month for insurance. It's just ridiculous. And yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I've definitely thought of that as an option, as you know, flying somewhere else to get treated, which is not something anyone I know of would have thought of probably, you know, 10 years ago. But now it's becoming more and more of an option.
Yeah, it's going global, and you know, you probably notice, you know, people in the operating room, they look over at the guy about to operate on them and realize he's from India.
Yeah.
And so all sorts of doctors from overseas are trained in the U.S., certified in the U.S. and certified in other countries. And then Indian certification has gotten really stringent. And the Cayman Islands passed a law that we accept Indian doctors. You don't have to go get U.S. certification. And this is medicine is going global. People travel overseas for healthcare, and you can get a bypass surgery. It's like more than $100,000 in the U.S. You go to India, it's, you know, 1/10 of the price.
Yeah.
And if you can provide something similar in a seastead just off the coast of Los Angeles or New York, you could just drive costs down and have the best doctors from all over the world working on that thing, making more money, being treated better. Yeah, we can. Seasteads can put government systems out of business.
That's exciting. That's really exciting. And the cool thing about the ships is there's already a pretty strong precedent for hospital ships. I mean, I know in the Navy we had the USS Mercy was a hospital ship, and then with the excellent cruise ships that are out there, you know, I would think it would be kind of a slam dunk to convert one of those into, you know, a floating hospital and start courting that market.
Is the USS Mercy the same as the Mercy Ships, the Christian charity that brings ships to the third world?
That's different. And I might even have the name wrong on the U.S. ship, but the U.S. has one hospital ship, and I think it's based out of San Diego. But no, it's completely different. I believe the Mercy ships that you're talking about are private. That's my understanding.
Yeah, there's like two different things. There's the fabulous floating hospital that the Navy has, demonstrating that you can have these things and you can even have surgeries on them.
Right.
And then there's Mercy ships, which is a Christian charity ship, which these visionary Christians figured out that people in the third world with no access to healthcare that have terrible diseases and injuries, many of them live within, 100 miles of a port. And you could bring a fabulous hospital ship into port, and just through word of mouth, people hear about it and they come running to the ship to get their various problems dealt with. And it's a hugely successful charity. And I use that as a precedent for, like, if you can – I wish I had the number in front of me of the number of people that they have serviced. It's in the millions.
Wow.
And if you can run the Christian Mercy ships on charity.
Yeah.
Imagine if you had for-profit permanent seasteads stationed a ferry ride away from some of these places. And then you did the same kind of jurisdictional arbitrage where – you're offering, say, a stem cell therapy, which is not available in the U.S., to a seastead off the coast of Africa. Americans will fly there to get the treatment for one-tenth the price, and then you're using that profit to subsidize your services to the poor people in, say, Africa or India.
Yeah.
This is the business model that already works in India with Devi Shetty's model. And now he's building hospitals in the Cayman Islands to keep this going.
Wow. And
the question is, why use real islands and why use temporary ships? Why not build islands? He's already made billions and billions doing this.
Hmm.
This is a business model that could pay for seasteads.
Yeah, so you've laid out an impressive roadmap for the future there. I mean, to me, the biggest challenge is always the engineering challenge, but the things that you've laid out, I mean, and now you've kind of thrown the market incentives in there to make that happen. So
yeah,
it's exciting. It's really exciting.
And the engineering challenge is nothing to sneeze at. It really isn't. But as a demonstration of the fact that if you have a business model in place, then technical challenges get solved. When I first got involved with the Seasteading Institute, and I got all excited that we could have these things in international waters, there was an expert that just kind of got me on the phone and chewed me out about how difficult it is to have permanent structures on the high seas and how they can't last more than a decade, and you got to bring them in, and you don't know how expensive these things are, and if the oil industry can't solve the problem, how are you? Mm-hmm. Within 6 months of that conversation, Shell announced that they're putting the Prelude, I think it's like 125 kilometers off the coast of Australia.
Wow.
The thing is bigger than
the
Empire State Building. Yeah, most people haven't. It's going to be in international waters for 25 years.
So this is a platform, or it's a ship?
It's like a ship that has to be so stable on the high seas that you are sending a pipe all the way down into the deep water to get the natural gas.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to be fueling ships out there, and then it has to, the technical challenges are unbelievable, and it's already designed to be at sea for 25 years. It's going to be pulling up natural gas from the deep, deep ocean. It's in international waters. It's 150 feet longer than the Empire State Building is high.
Wow.
And these are using, current technology, to say nothing of the technology that's emerging in the next couple of decades. And so it's led me to define expert as anyone that can explain to me in detail why something will never work 6 months before it works. It's like the network. So like once they discover that there's an unbelievable amount of natural gas all the way down there, all of a sudden
Right. People
are motivated to solve technical challenges. another one, you know, just to throw another crazy new breakthrough out there. Cruise ships sometimes gets criticized for putting too much particulates in the air. Mm-hmm. And so cruise ships are interested in making themselves more green. So they were interested in, well, how do we move through the water using less energy? And they came up with a technology that sounds like something out of a fantasy, which is basically the hull of the ship gives off all these little bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing making contact with the ocean is not the hull of the ship, but these little tiny bubbles. And this cuts down, it basically cuts down the friction of the ship moving through the water.
Okay.
So now you have gigantic cruise ships moving through the water on little beds of bubbles. This is happening right now.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Like all these little innovations are emerging to make
yeah.
life at sea, you know, greener, better, faster, cheaper. So I think if you could convince Devi Shetty and Bob Ballard and 3D printing people, if they all got in a room and started discussing the business model to pay back the cost of seasteads, I think something could emerge.
Yeah, that I think that's probably you said a lot of exciting things in this interview, but I think that's one of the most exciting. The idea of 3D printing these seasteads. I'm a hobbyist 3D printer. I'm a hobbyist and I have a 3D printer, and it's incredible. You know what's being done with that technology, and it's, you know, it's all open source stuff, and so anybody can get into it and start tinkering around with it and making it better. And I think that's really exciting.
And it's happening. Like when I first started to get into 3D printing, what was it, 3 years ago? And I was amazed at the intricacy of the structures that were already being printed. And I was saying to myself, man, pretty soon they're going to have houses. Well, that's probably going to happen in 5 or 10 years. Then next year, this Chinese company printed, they claim like 10 houses in 24 hours or something.
Yeah.
I looked it up on the internet. I started posting. I'm like, they've already got houses. And people are like, well, it looks kind of ugly and crude. It looks like a clay house. And I'm like, yeah, but in 5 or 10 years, there's going to be mansions. Then like 1 year later,
yeah,
they've got fabulous mansions and apartment houses that look beautiful. They look better than the apartment houses in San Francisco. So it's already taking off. And I'm
yeah.
saying, man, 3D printed cities are coming soon. And you know, you see the print heads now, pretty soon they're going to be as fast as a blur.
Yeah.
Man, when I type my design, if I'm an architect, I just type it and send it and people can print it. And 3D printers are getting house sized. It's just all bets are going to be off, man.
Yeah, that to me that was one of the coolest things about 3D printing was I could go on to GrabCAD or, you know, Thingiverse or any other website and pull this electronic file, you know, that somebody else had created and download it and then print it and have the physical object, you know, right there. And that it blew me away. And then I've gone to some 3D printing expos and the advancements are just incredible. And especially if you can put that together with, you know, with entrepreneurs that that aren't afraid of innovation and aren't afraid of trying new things and, you know, aren't even afraid of failing, you know, are afraid to put themselves out there. Like you said, you can have within a year, you know, go from nothing to a 3D printed house to now a 3D printed mansion. You know, there really is no limit to it.
And then you combine that. It's the confluence of all these different things when you combine that with advancements in materials. So my colleague, Chris Mulia, he's partnered with Julia Greer, who's a nanotechnology innovator in California. And you know, it's only been initial discussions, but she has she's making nanomaterials that are literally stronger than steel and lighter than a feather.
Wow.
And, you know, and they also they have some springiness to them so they can absorb shocks and then bounce back and still be solid. And so we're getting stronger materials that are much lighter, and she's making them porous like bones, like following the biomimicry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we're in the situation where we're talking about tiny little materials and it takes work to produce them. But you're seeing that this, too, is going to become an information technology to a large extent. And if these different developments come together and we have nano, we could design things down to the level of beneath the micron, which is smaller than a human hair, and we have cities designed like this, and then all we have to do is get outside existing building and code structures that become obsolete in this new paradigm, and you build these things on the ocean. We just need. I'm looking at it as these puzzle pieces are all slowly assembling, and they're assembling on the ocean.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that has been a lot of exciting ideas that we've been talking about today. So I think that's about all the time that I have for right now. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up related to seasteading or any other projects that you're working on?
Well, I want to say, first of all, Anthony, I really appreciate what you're doing. And I want you to know I get solicited a lot by the media, and I have to turn them down because I'm busy. But I still appreciate the vision of your sort of startup podcast. I had to do yours. And I would tell your listeners to check out our Floating City project, which is our first baby step to the seas. Fill out our survey and let us know what you want to see on a floating city. And, you know, we rely on, you know, lots of volunteers, over 1,000 donors, and see if you want to be a part of the community and let us know how you can help. And we need, you know, everything we need to build society, we need to build floating society. So any skill, any ability, this is just an expanding community. And I think it's a very exciting next step for humanity. If you want to be a part of it, check out seasteading.org.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And thank you so much for your kind words, and really appreciate your time today and you accepting the interview. So thanks. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Free Cities Podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback on this episode at freecitiespodcast.com. If you like this show, please make sure to click subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud so you'll never miss another episode. A positive review of this podcast on any of these platforms will go a long way towards helping us spread the message that there are voluntary alternatives to force. If you prefer to listen online, you can also find this podcast at liberty.me or on our website, freecitiespodcast.com. If you'd like to support this podcast at no cost to you, please consider making your next Amazon purchase through the Amazon widget at freecitiespodcast.com. Also at freecitiespodcast.com, you can sign up for our mailing list and get instant access to the closed Facebook group for Free Cities Podcast. There, you can discuss the ideas we talked about on the show with the guests and host. Until next time, wishing you peace, prosperity, and freedom.